Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Clausewitz, A Very Short Introduction, by Michael Howard, narrated by Corey James. Introduction. About Karl von Clausewitz's study on war, the American strategic thinker Bernard Brody has made the bold statement, "His is not simply the greatest, but the only great book about war." It is difficult to disagree. Anyone trying to put together a collection of texts on military theory comparable to anthologies on social, political, or economic thought will find it hard to match Clausewitz. Few of any other writers on war have succeeded as he did in transcending the limitations imposed on their insights by the political or the technological circumstances of their times. We can find many whose writings illustrate how successive generations have thought about war, but there are remarkably few who can help us to think about it, who have penetrated below the ephemeral phenomena of their own times and considered war not just as a craft, but as a great socio-political activity distinguished from all other activities by the reciprocal and legitimized use of purposeful violence to attain political objectives. There is certainly the magisterial study by Sun Tzu, The Art of War, probably written in the 4th century BC. There are a few chapters in the works of Clausewitz's contemporary, Jomini. There are passages scattered among the works of Liddell Hart and his eccentric contemporary, J.F.C. Fuller, and there are many interesting insights to be excavated from the writings of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Trotsky. Among earlier writers, one can glean much bleak wisdom from the obiter dicta of Thucydides and Machiavelli. But there is no systemic study comparable to that of Clausewitz. Military analysts are usually concerned rather to advise their own generations and their own societies than to distill lasting wisdom for posterity. Clausewitz expressed the modest hope that his book would not be forgotten after 2 or 3 years and might be picked up more than once by those who are interested in the subject. But his main concern was to help his countrymen and his contemporaries. He was a member of the Prussian officer corps, loyal to the Hohenzollern dynasty, though more conscious than most of the problems it faced in coming to terms with the political currents set in motion by the French Revolution. He believed that the menace of French aggression had been checked by the European powers in 1814-15, but by no means destroyed. And if he sought to understand war in the abstract, it was only to ensure that in future Prussia and her allies would be able to wage it more swiftly and effectively against the hereditary foe. Above all, he was a professional soldier writing for his professional colleagues, not an academic lecturing in a political science faculty. He quite deliberately limited his analysis to what was likely to be of immediate utility to a commander planning a campaign. He had the practical man's horror of abstractions that could not be directly related to the facts of the situation, of propositions that could not be illustrated by examples, of material that was not relevant to the problem in hand. Certainly as a thinker, he sought to penetrate to the essence of his subject matter. But he was always concerned to link theory to action, and he deliberately ignored all aspects of his subject that were not of immediate relevance to the conduct of the kind of war with which he himself was familiar. "The conduct of war," he wrote, "has nothing to do with making guns and powder out of coal, sulphur, saltpeter, copper, and tin. Its given quantities are weapons that are ready for use and their effectiveness. Strategy uses maps without worrying about trigonometrical surveys. It does not inquire how a country should be organized and a people trained and ruled in order to produce the best military results. It takes these matters as it finds them in the European community of nations." To that extent, therefore, Clausewitz deliberately sacrificed universality to pragmatism and simplicity. It may, however, be doubted whether he was conscious of quite how much he was sacrificing. It is easy enough after two world wars to criticize a theory of war that excluded all consideration of the economic base that makes the fighting of war possible at all. But to do this is not just to evoke the wisdom of hindsight. It demanded a very narrow view of the nature of war to study the Napoleonic period so intensively, as did Clausewitz, without taking into account the part played in Napoleon's strategy, and perhaps in his downfall, by the continental system. His attempt to use economic as well as military instruments to consolidate and extend his conquests. Clausewitz's ignorance of the whole maritime dimension of warfare is striking, but not surprising. The oceans lay beyond his cultural horizons. It is more curious that a Prussian specialist on military questions, whose country had been established as a major military power as much through skill in economic management as by military victories, should virtually ignore a dimension of military affairs that had occupied the forefront of the mind of every Prussian soldier, statesman, and bourgeois since the days of Frederick William I. Perhaps this one-sidedness reflected the limitations of Clausewitz's own personality and interests. More probably, it was the impact of the great Napoleonic campaigns that shaped his career and dominated his thinking, campaigns whose dramatic course and cataclysmic results overshadowed the humdrum concerns of military budgeting and administration that had so obsessed the old Prussian army. When it came to the point, it was the successful conduct of operations that mattered, and the events of Clausewitz's lifetime had made it clear that it was to this, and not to the deeper questions relating to military financing, budgeting, procurement, and administration, that attention had most urgently to be given. Clausewitz's ignoring of the economic dimension of war was thus, at least in part, deliberate. His ignoring of another dimension, the technological, was unconscious and more easily understandable. Like most of his intelligent contemporaries, he realized very well that he had been born into a revolutionary era likely to transform, for better or worse, the entire political structure of European society. But no more than anyone else could he appreciate that he was living on the eve of a technological transformation of yet vaster scope. The conduct of war is determined above all by two factors: the nature of the weapons available and the modes of transportation. The first had remained stable for 100 years, the second for 1,000. In Clausewitz's day, as in Caesar's, logistics were determined by the speed and endurance of marching men and of draft animals. Tactics were determined, as they had been in the age of Marlborough, by firearms whose effective range was 50 yards and cannon with a range of 300. And although there had been significant incremental developments during the past century, developments whose significance Clausewitz analyzes most interestingly in the course of On War, there was no reason to expect the transformation, both in transportation and in armaments, that began in the decade following Clausewitz's death in 1831, with the development of railways and the introduction of breech-loading rifled firearms. Much of On War is therefore of interest only to military historians, dealing as it does with detailed questions of tactics and logistics that were to be out of date within a few decades of Clausewitz's death. What is remarkable, however, is how much of what Clausewitz had to say did outlast his time and remain relevant, not only under military circumstances transformed out of all recognition, but for a readership far broader than the officers of the Prussian army, whose education he primarily had in mind. Why this should be so, it will be the purpose of this volume to explain. Chapter 1. Clausewitz in his time. The active career of Karl von Clausewitz exactly spanned the course of the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars between 1792 and 1815. He was born in 1780, the son of a half-pay lieutenant in the Prussian army, and at the age of 12 obtained a commission in the 34th Infantry Regiment, which was at the time commanded by a distant relative. But his family was not a military, much less an aristocratic one. His father, whose own forebears had been bourgeois and academic, had been commissioned by Frederick the Great only during the crisis period of the Seven Years' War, when the exclusive barriers of the Prussian officer corps had been reluctantly lowered to admit members of the middle classes. And he had been retired after that war, not, as he and his family gave out, as a result of wounds received on active service, but in consequence of Frederick's reduction of the officer corps to its original nucleus of well-born landed gentry, Junkers. Thus, although Clausewitz passed his life as a member of that exclusive body, and was even to gain entry into the entourage of the royal family, he was temperamentally an outsider, and the way in which he was ultimately treated by Frederick William III and his court suggests that he was seen as such. Clausewitz was always something of an introvert, solitary, bookish, shy, intellectually arrogant. An autodidact, he devoured literature on any available topic, not only military affairs, but philosophy, politics, art, and education. He was a prolific, almost a compulsive writer on all these matters. From the age of 20 until his death in 1831, his writing was only briefly interrupted by the demands of military campaigning, and no complete edition of his work has ever been compiled. But beneath the scholarly, withdrawn exterior, there burned an ambition for military glory worthy of Stendhal's Julian Sorel, an ambition deeply repressed, given vent only in his letters to his wife, never to be fulfilled in the series of staff appointments for which his superiors considered, probably rightly, that his intellectual talents best fitted him, but one that gave a peculiar intensity to his analyses of the qualities demanded of a commander in the field, of the intense moral pressures that commanders must learn to withstand, and of the bloody drama of battle that was the natural, indeed the desirable, climax of all his endeavours. All Clausewitz's writings bear the stamp of a passionate temperament, as often at war with, as in the service of, a powerful analytic mind. Clausewitz was no desk soldier. He received his baptism of fire at the age of 13, when the Prussian army, on the left wing of the forces of the First Coalition, containing and driving back the armies of the First French Republic, was campaigning first on the Rhine, then in the Vosges. Advancing across that broad valley, trudging up and down those steep wooded mountain tracks, he inquired that infantryman's familiarity with terrain that was to inspire so many pages of On War. The campaign ended with the Treaty of Bâle in 1795, and Prussia withdrew into a precarious and self-deluding state of non-alignment, from which she was to be cruelly aroused 11 years later. The first 5 years of this period was spent by Clausewitz on garrison duty in the small town of Neuruppin. Intelligent soldiers never waste the long periods of leisure that characterize peacetime service. Clausewitz made good use of the excellent library of Frederick the Great's brother, Prince Henry, which was open to the officers of his regiment, and he acquired a deep practical interest in education. Activities, it may be assumed, that did not engage the interests of his fellow subalterns quite so profoundly. It must nevertheless have come as something of a relief when in 1801 he was transferred to Berlin to attend the newly opened war college under the direction of Gerd von Scharnhorst. It was now at the age of 19 that his career really began. Scharnhorst is rightly revered as one of the giants in the creation of Germany, a man as distinguished as a thinker and a statesman as he was a soldier. A Hanoverian by birth, and an artilleryman by training, two characteristics that set him apart from the Junker cavalry and infantry officers who dominated the Prussian army, his brilliant performance in the War of the First Coalition gained for him universal respect, and his appointment as director of the First Prussian Staff College was remarkably wise. From the beginning of the wars, he had been puzzling over the performance of the French revolutionary armies. How was it that this rabble, untrained, undisciplined, under-officered, its generals as often as not jumped-up NCOs, with no adequate supply system, let alone any serious administrative structure, how did it come about that these remarkable forces could not only hold their own against the professional soldiers of the European powers, but actually defeat them? It was true that the French made ingenious use of the new flexible and dispersed infantry formations which the Royal Army had been developing before the Revolution, and that in the materiel, the tactics and the training of their artillery, they were second to none. But the reasons for their military success lay deeper than that. The success of the French armies, Scharnhorst discerned, was closely connected with the transformation of the society that lay behind them, with the emergence of the idea of a French nation. To learn how to defeat the French, it was not enough just to study their military techniques, essential though this might be. One had to consider the political context as well, and the historical background against which these techniques had emerged. The syllabus of the Kriegsakademie was thus liberal as well as technical, and Scharnhorst supplemented it with a discussion group, the Militärische Gesellschaft, where no limit was observed in considering the implications of the military revolution of the time. This was the setting in which the young Clausewitz now found himself, and he quickly attached himself to Scharnhorst as a deeply admiring disciple, his own ideas germinating and sprouting in the rays of that genial sun. Scharnhorst reciprocated with an equal affection for the brilliant and receptive young man. The foundation was laid for a partnership that was to end only with Scharnhorst's premature death in 1813, and was to bring Clausewitz into the heart of the group of military reformers, Grolman, Boyen, Gneisenau, among others, who were to remould the Prussian army and work towards the remaking of the Prussian state. But the opportunity for this still lay in the future, and Clausewitz's immediate prospects, though glittering, were more orthodox. Graduating at the head of his class in 1803, he was appointed adjutant to Prince August, the son of his regiment's colonel-in-chief, Prince Ferdinand, and at the end of the year, in the house of his patron, he met and fell in love with Marie, daughter of the Count von Bruhl, a lively and well-educated girl, high in the favour of Queen Louise. The family's resistance to this unsuitable match and the demands of military service delayed the marriage for 7 years, which made possible the long, passionate, self-revealing correspondence in which Clausewitz developed many of his ideas. Once married, Marie was to identify herself wholeheartedly with her husband's work, act as his amanuensis, and after his death as his editor, and preside over what still remains the most complete edition of his works, which she published in 1832-4. During the next 2 years, 1803-5, Clausewitz wrote prolifically, developing ideas that were to receive their final form 20 years later, when he came to write On War. Then in 1806 came the war with France, that the cautious King Frederick William III had done his best to avoid, but to which Clausewitz, like most other patriotic young officers, looked forward with impatient enthusiasm. His master, Prince August, was given command of a battalion, and Clausewitz accompanied him to the battlefield of Auerstadt. There he participated in his first great Napoleonic battle and in the catastrophic retreat that followed, an experience so shatteringly different from the tedious marches and manoeuvres of his boyhood that it was hard for him to comprehend them both as belonging to the single activity, war. He and Prince August were eventually cut off and taken prisoner. While Scharnhorst and his colleagues were retrieving the reputation of the Prussian army in the Eylau campaign the following year, Clausewitz languished in bitter, if not uncomfortable, exile with his royal master in France, until they were repatriated after the Peace of Tilsit in 1808. It was a humiliating experience that stoked the fires of Clausewitz's patriotic zeal and gave him a lifelong dislike for all things French. Released from captivity, Clausewitz rejoined Scharnhorst, who was now in Königsberg, remote from the French-dominated capital of Berlin, working to reorganize the Prussian army. For the next 4 years he helped with the task of reshaping the structure of Prussian military institutions, simultaneously writing on every conceivable aspect of his subject, from the details of minor tactics to the problems of political loyalty. The latter became insoluble for him when, in the spring of 1812, the king, whose uniform he wore and whose claims on his loyalty he had never questioned, concluded an alliance with the French enemy Clausewitz so detested. It was too much. In company with some 30 other officers, Clausewitz resigned his commission, parted again from his wife, and took service with Emperor Alexander I of Russia, just as the French and their satellite armies were invading that empire. Although Clausewitz spoke no Russian, employment was found for him in various advisory positions on the staff. He took his part in his second great battle at Borodino. He witnessed the disastrous crossing of the Beresina by the retreating French army, and wrote a horrifying account of it. Finally, he acted as an intermediary when, in December 1812, the commander of the Prussian corps serving under Napoleon's command, York von Wartenberg, took his historic decision to capitulate at Tauroggen and go over with his forces to the side of the Russians. When York established a center of Prussian national resistance at Königsberg, Clausewitz organized the arming of the population. And when, in the spring of 1813, the King of Prussia himself at last abandoned Napoleon, Clausewitz returned to Berlin, rejoined Scharnhorst, and again helped him to raise new armies, channeling the enthusiasm and self-sacrifice of the subjects of the Hohenzollerns, who were beginning to think of themselves as Germans. When the campaign of 1813 opened, Clausewitz accompanied the army to the field. But he was still denied the position of command he wanted so badly. The king had still not forgiven him for what he saw as his disloyal conduct, and a further year passed before he readmitted Clausewitz to his service. So it was wearing the uniform of a Russian officer that Clausewitz served as advisor to the Prussian army commander, Marshal Blücher, during the Leipzig campaign. When in 1814 he was at last readmitted to the Prussian army, he was given command only of a nondescript force, the German Legion, serving in North Germany, far from the main battlefields in France. Not until 1815 was he readmitted to the Prussian General Staff and appointed Chief of Staff to General von Thielmann's Third Army Corps. This formation served on the extreme left wing of the Allied forces in Belgium and fought a stubborn defensive action against a force double its size under Marshal Grouchy, while Napoleon was trying so unsuccessfully to break through the Allied centre before Waterloo. In its unspectacular role, Three Corps contributed as much to the Allied victory as any of the troops engaged under Wellington or Blücher, but Clausewitz again felt cheated. He took no part in the pursuit of the defeated French, and his hopes of winning glory on the battlefield faded for good. Scharnhorst was now dead, but his place, both as leader of the reforming wing of the Prussian army and as Clausewitz's principal patron, had been taken by August von Gneisenau, another non-Prussian, he was born in Saxony, in the royal service. Gneisenau was appointed commander-in-chief of the Prussian forces in the west, and Clausewitz became his chief of staff. The headquarters at Mainz acquired in Berlin a reputation for nationalism, if not radicalism, certainly for dangerous independence of thought. First Gneisenau, then in 1813 Clausewitz, were recalled to Berlin, where they could be kept more closely under the royal eye. For Clausewitz, a place was found as director of the War College, the Allgemeine Kriegsschule, but his opportunities there of influencing the political or even the military thinking of the Prussian officer corps were slight. His duties were purely administrative, and after his initial proposals for reform had been rebuffed, he made no effort to develop them. For 12 years he remained undisturbed, writing studies of the Napoleonic campaigns and drafts for the comprehensive study on war that he projected as early as 1816. These drafts were still incomplete when in 1830 Clausewitz was posted first to the command of a major artillery formation in Breslau, then, when the simultaneous risings in Paris and in Poland made a new war seem probable, as chief of staff to his old chief Gneisenau, now in command of the Prussian army. The danger of war passed, to be succeeded by one yet more frightening, cholera, spreading from the east. The last task assigned to Clausewitz was to organize a cordon sanitaire to check the advance of the epidemic into Germany. But it was a problem his strategic insights could not solve. He himself caught the disease and died within 24 hours at Breslau on 16 November 1831 at the age of 51. Although he never obtained the independent command for which he longed, Clausewitz enjoyed, like so many officers of his generation, an experience of warfare almost unprecedented in its variety. The army, which he joined in 1792, was the small, homogeneous, professional force of Frederick the Great. That in which he served from 1813 to 1815, and which he had done so much to create, was a great national army based on compulsory service, powerfully backed up by territorial units of volunteers and by an angry, self-conscious nation. His early experience had been in 18th-century campaigns of manoeuvre and siege warfare. Before he was 40, he had taken part in some of the greatest battles in the history of warfare, and seen the armies of Napoleon storm their way across Europe to Moscow, only to be driven back again with little expectation of permanence. All this had been the result of military operations, but it was clear to Clausewitz, as a very young man, that the explanation for the success or failure of these operations was not to be sought on the battlefield alone. Military analysis, if it was to be of any practical value to posterity, had to be carried to a deeper level than ever before. The intellectual background. There had been no lack of effort before Clausewitz's time in applying scientific principles to the conduct of war. Throughout the 18th century there was a widespread impatience that, in an age when the universe was yielding more and more of its secrets to scientific inquiry, and when reason was replacing custom and superstition as the criterion of human judgment, the conduct of war should still be such a clumsy, wasteful, and uncertain business. "Every science has principles and rules," wrote the great 18th-century general Prince Maurice of Saxony, "only that of war has none." It was a lack widely lamented among professional soldiers for reasons that I shall consider in a moment, but enlightened civilian thinkers lamented that war should survive at all as a relic of a barbarous past. This opinion was widespread throughout Europe, but for two reasons it was particularly strong in Prussia. In the first place, the experiences of the Seven Years' War, 1756-63, when Prussian territory had been repeatedly fought over and the resources of both state and people had been almost exhausted, had created throughout the Prussian intelligentsia a profound aversion to war, not unlike that in France and Britain after the First World War, and one that Frederick the Great did nothing to discourage. He himself had had enough fighting to last him a lifetime. In the second place, Frederick deliberately reverted to the military policy of his forebears and eliminated the middle classes from both the officer corps and the ranks of his army, leaving them free to make the money which the Prussian state, so barren of natural resources.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?